Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
All right, what is up, Gypsy Gang? We are back for another episode of the Gypsy Tales podcast, and this is a bit of a treat for me because my guest today is Lachlan Giles, the man that we call Lockyagi. He is one of the best jiu-jitsu competitors in the world, and he's also one of the best jiu-jitsu coaches in the world. I spent 10 days with him in Thailand when I first started jiu-jitsu, actually, and has just always remained a really good friend. Since then, he has gone on to get on the podium in the open weight division at ADCC, which is like the Olympics of grappling, essentially. And then after, that was actually a year ago. And then he basically went on this crazy seminar world tour, teaching his style of jiu-jitsu that was able to beat the best grapplers in the world. And then from there, COVID kind of shut down what he had going on. And they've also had to deal with a lot through COVID because their gym is actually in Melbourne. So got lucky on via the like a face chat sort of deal through the internet, and he only had 2 hours the first day, and I was like, damn, I really want to make sure that we get 3 hours on this one. So we ended up having another chat, but that one went for almost 2 hours, so I've split this up basically into just our two chats, very jiu-jitsu specific, but I think that you'd find some of, I guess, just the concepts around learning and the ways to learn applicable to any sport, hopefully. Lockie's such an awesome dude, and a guy that I've got a lot of time for and a lot of respect for, and when he talks about jiu-jitsu, I definitely want to listen. Just got to give a shout out to our sponsors. The guys at Macro Kitchen, you can head to macrokitchen.com.au. You can use the code GypsyGang10 for 10% off. They're fresh, never frozen meals. They do delivery and pick up. You can just order through the website. And whenever I'm busy, super busy with work, and I'm just doing a lot of late night sort of stuff, I'll just sort of do a week where I just don't cook, and I just kind of commit to doing the Macro Kitchen thing. And it just saves so much time. Don't like to do it constantly. I do like to cook, but man, when I've got to, it's definitely the easiest way for me to eat really good, healthy food. We're also brought to you by the guys at CMBT Combat Nutrition. You can head to cmbt.com.au and you can use the code GYPSY for 15% off. These guys are my go-to for my supplements in terms of my sport recovery. I will take their Octane while I'm working out, while I'm doing jiu-jitsu, and then I'll always take their protein after. So been working with these guys for, I'd say, well over a year now, and yeah, just got nothing but good things to say. So if you are looking for some fuel during your sport or some protein for recovery after, then look no further than the guys at Combat. We're also brought to you by the guys at Crick's Tweed. You can head to crickstweed.com.au. Give him a call, ask for Kyle. He is the man. They're also giving away that 2020 model KTM 450. All you've got to do is buy a new or used car from Cricks, and you will basically go in the draw to win. They are getting pretty close to drawing that, so might be a really good time to get in and get yourself a new or used car. We're also brought to you by the guys at Dixon Quality. You can head to Dixon Quality flynoz.com.au. They're always dropping new flynos and they're always selling out. So definitely want to get on there quick. You can use the code RAMPTHIEF for 15% off. Righto, that is it from me. Enjoy this two-part episode with the man, the myth, the legend, Lachlan Giles. Lachlan Giles is back, not exactly in studio, but we're gonna do another hour or so because, you know, a bit selfish with my Lockie time. I feel like I just can't be breaking the mold and just going 2 hours on you. I feel like you're the guest that I kind of want to go 4 hours on, you know.
4 hours. All right, let's do it.
So happy anniversary, actually. I literally just saw
that ADCC.
ADCC run was exactly 1 year ago, and that's sort of where we left off the chat. I figure you're probably, I guess you're not like sick of talking about ADCC, but you definitely went on a bit of a podcast run. Everybody wanted to know how it happened.
Yeah, it was definitely, it slowly dwindled, which is nice. So it's, I'm definitely not, well, every time I think about it, I mean, it's just a huge moment. So, for me, that is so, it's pretty cool to have that. I don't know if I'll ever have something. I think even if I did really well, I think even if I did the same thing at this ADCC, it wouldn't be as cool just because, you know, I wouldn't say it's expected, but it would be more unexpected what happened then than it would be now. So,
yeah, I tell you, one of my few regrets in life is that I was too broke to afford a plane ticket to Melbourne. We'd spoken about, like, I mean, fuck, it was probably just me and Andrew just like hyping each other up. But that whole camp, obviously, Andrew was training at Absolute the whole time that you were in the lead up, and I'd talk to him weekly, and he's like, fuck, bro, the Lockie Arg is in fine form, bro. Fucking, he's going to get a fucking medal. I know it for sure. And, you know, we were both just, you know, G'ing up so hard about your chances. And we thought, you know, we're like, it's going to be him and Lapree in the final. And, you know, we just had these crazy expectations. There was just a feeling that I had. And like I said, it was probably just because of Andrew just hyping it up every time we spoke. But I was like, I got to get down there. And we have to do like a video of what you guys were going through. And
he's a good hype man, Andrew.
Oh, dude, he's the man. He needs his own podcast. But that's one of my regrets, because in the end, you ended up doing exactly what we both thought that you would do. We just thought it would be in your weight division, not the absolute.
Yeah, it was. Well, the funniest, the biggest regret story out of that would be there's a guy, Richard, who flew to ADCC to watch the event, and then I think he'd booked it, so like he was leaving. He's basically flying out on the night of the open weight. Oh,
That's worse.
He watched us all compete, and obviously, you know, mixed success. Craig had done quite well in his weight division, so I got to see that, but then left and missed the open weight.
He fully cooked it. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. That's worse. But, man, I was so happy that you got that medal, and, like, I mean, it was just so – I remember I was actually training during the – I was like, oh, sweet, hopefully we can sort of watch it all. But it ended up taking place over like hours, and I ended up going to training, and then we ended up watching you versus Gordon, and I was just like, man, this is absolutely incredible. Like, and, you know, I think I was even watching you versus Ali in the car while I was driving to training, and it was just like, man, it was so, like, you know that it's a massive achievement when, like, I mean, it's not like we're best mates or nothing, but, you know, like, I had such a crazy proud feeling of, like, even, you know, knowing a small part of what you went through and just seeing the way that you trained and taught, and to see somebody that, you know, you do look up to and respect do something that was just so phenomenal and just such a massive achievement. Like, even, you know, the small you know, whatever, like, small tie I have, it just still was such a proud moment, you know?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I got a few funny stories. Well, I've heard a few funny stories of people being at work and yelling, you know, just screaming out of nowhere.
Yeah.
clients not knowing what's going on. And yeah, so yeah, I mean, it's awesome, the support. It's actually, I wish I could kind of, I'm sure I missed like a whole bunch of messages. I think, you know, I got a kind of influx of
messages for sure.
And so on then, and I couldn't even keep up with it. So I probably missed a whole bunch of really cool stories and funny things people were telling me about what they were doing when when I got that result. But anyway, so I think they're gone now.
So that I guess the way that you did win, like, I think what was the way you won those matches to get into, you know, the bronze medal position was essentially your system as well. And I think that that's something that took the jiu-jitsu world by storm in a way, because the, you know, all you've ever heard is like the Danaher death squad and the leg lock system from Danaher. And then here you were doing essentially like a really old position that you made new again in 50-50. And like, it, no one was ready for it. Obviously all the guys that you face weren't ready for it. And you just went through these guys so quickly. And whether Gordon wants to admit it or not, like, there was one exchange where you were almost on a leg and he really did back out. And he can say whatever the fuck he wants, but that was very clear to see. And that's fine. Like, he won the gold medal and he should have backed away from you, doing the leg attacks that you were doing. But it was, I think, just such a huge surprise to people the way that you were able to beat those guys. And it was with this new system. And I think that that was cool in the sense that it almost feel like it really just not only legitimized your competitive, like, you as a competitor, but then as like a jiu-jitsu mind and as a jiu-jitsu thinker and as a coach, I think that you equally achieved the same level or status in two different ways, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a funny one. I mean, I don't think that success, like competition success, should influence how people view you as a coach, for example. You know, like, obviously, like, my instructional sales went up quite a lot after the ADCC performance, but I'm like, it's still the same product.
It's the same shit
for you to get. You know, like, you could have bought the same thing a month ago when, you know, like, there's certainly that part. And I think we should be careful to just look to who's winning the tournaments as necessarily who we should be following from a technical point of view and so on, you know. Like, I think there's so much that goes into winning a competition or being the best competitor that is beyond just technique, you know? Like, technique is really important, but there's like athleticism, timing. You could have the best technique, but you're just like one of those people that doesn't get the timing very well. Power, flexibility, instinct, nerves. So many things play into it that you could maybe the most, I always say this, but maybe the most technical, there could be the guy that's competing and coming, you know, 16th at the Worlds. You know, you don't even hear about him.
Yeah.
He kind of like misses out by quite a lot in winning the World Championships, but that could be the most technical person in terms of like their actual knowledge and systems could be the best in the world, but they're just not maybe if they were doing what everyone else is doing, they'd be losing first round and everything, whereas they might be, you know, their ability in that front might be getting them really far, but they don't have the other attributes to take them there. So, that's why I think we shouldn't just look at competition success. But it's nice, obviously, it is nice to, you know, I've probably had a good 10, you know, well, I'd be probably the last 10 years I've been competing internationally, like flying to Worlds, flying from Australia to the World Championship level competitions and trying to, you know, get a good result. And I had a bronze medal at the Nogi Worlds in 2017. That was my best result up until ADCC, but obviously ADCC is another level, you know, especially compared to Nogi Worlds is kind of...
It's the redheaded stepchild.
It's a World Championship. Like, it is a Nogi World Championship, but it's like, it's you know, nowhere near the same level of prestige as ADCC, and a lot of, like, you'd probably only get of the 16 people in your division at ADCC, you might only get 3 or 4 of them doing no-gi worlds. You know, it's not the full bracket. Like, a lot of people don't compete no-gi worlds, so it was nice to obviously get that ADCC medal. It was very, and I, to be honest, I was 33 at the time, 34 now, but I was kind of starting to think that maybe, you know, my one exceptional performance may or may not happen. But you know, as long as I really did feel that I was improved, like in training, I really felt I'd improved a lot. I think like what Andrew was saying too, but like, I did feel that my level was going up and up and up, and I'd really peaked for that tournament. So yeah, hope I can get that same rhythm going again next one.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's funny to go back to what you were saying about how competition results should not solely be the influence over what we buy from coaches, because, you know,
yeah, like, exactly.
Danaher famously hasn't really competed. And I mean, physically, he kind of can't even compete in a way, like, because of the physical challenge that he has. But there probably, you know, isn't many people in the world that watch as much jiu-jitsu as him and watch as much high level jiu-jitsu as him. And
he's, you know, I think as a coach, he's got, you know, you can see his students are doing well as well. So like,
there's an indication
there's definitely some. I think we have to be careful not, you know, like if someone has never competed before, I think it's probably easy for me, you know, after training for 17 years, and I can kind of look at a video on YouTube of someone showing a move, and I can kind of look and see whether it looks like it'll work or not, and whether it's worth trying just from kind of viewing it. But I think your average person probably can't do that. They'd have, like, so then you do have to be selective of who you watch. If you just kind of click on random guy on YouTube and watch, it may be good, but it could be terrible as well. So at least, you know, if you're getting a elite competitor teaching, you know, at least their moves probably work. Do they teach it well is another question.
Yeah, that's one thing that Shane, one of my coaches, has always said to me from day one, was like, man, you just can't watch everybody on YouTube. He's like, if a high level black belt isn't pulling it off in competition, and if you're not seeing that guard at, you know, the Gi World Championships every single year, it's probably not good. And if it's not from and even when, like, Flow Grappling will post those statistics of the submissions that happen at the ADCC level and takedowns, there's a very, very, very small cluster of techniques that find their way into the win column at the highest level. And they're always fairly basic shit. Like your rear naked choke and
your rear naked choke.
Exactly. And your like heel hook, you know, there's
triangles,
not
arm bars, heel hooks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's about choosing. I think that's actually probably, like, what your coach was saying is probably the best way to start doing techniques is what's the most prevalent at the highest level probably means that, that's almost like the amount of time you should spend working on that compared to other things, you know. If it's a weird, wacky move, then it can work, but also, you know, compared to something like a cross knee through pass or something, like something that you see all the time, like you see so many knee through passes that you'd be silly to not at least add that to your game and feel confident in that. Of course, I mean, I suppose on the, you can make a counter argument to that in that to beat someone who's better than you, sometimes you want to be doing something that's unexpected. You know, sometimes you want the thing that they don't see coming. But if you want to beat someone you're better than, you're often better at just doing what's common and what works well and what's kind of proven. But the issue there is that a lot of people see that, you know, they start doing a weird move, you know, they try to choke you from side control, and because no one expects someone to choke them from side control, they might get it on like one in every 10 people, and maybe even like on a maybe even on a purple belt or something, and they're like, that's you know, I tapped a purple belt from here, but I'm only a white belt or a blue belt, and that kind of reinforces that move, even though that same purple belt now will not give you that again, you know. That same purple belt will say, okay, I know what you're doing now. I'm not going to give you that. But there's already that reinforcement that's been occurring, and the person will kind of go down this path that's not in their best interest. I think, and you see that a lot. It's unfortunately it's the more boring answer, but work on the basics and the things that are more common. Yeah. And that's another thing of what is basics, you know. And for me, basics should be the things that work a lot.
That's a really good point.
So like when I say easy to do, it doesn't mean in rolling, but like, you know, there could be a move that's got like three steps to it, you know, and you might go, oh, that's a basic move because it's got three steps compared to move X, which has eight steps. But if move X works a lot better, then you're better off spending your time working that. So I do think there are some exceptions to that. I think something like the Berimbolo is almost got too many steps that I wouldn't get someone to do that immediately. You know, it just takes too long. There's so many steps and areas you can mess it up, even though it is high percentage. There's just too many areas to mess it up that to get someone right from the... Or I'd be very picky. There might be some people... I actually think someone like you would probably be able to pick up the Berimbolo quite well early on, just because I know like how you move and you learn fast and you got a good attitude to your training. So I could see you picking up the Berimbolo and actually working it, and it being, you know, you'd be happy that if it takes 3 to 6 months, but now then you're kind of getting it regularly, that's okay. But I think for most, you know, for some people that would take a year or a year and a half, and it can be very discouraging to be working on a move for, you know, and 6 months in, still not be able to really hit it a lot. So there is some element of truth to that. How many steps does the move have? But I also think the actual, how common it is probably a better indicator of what I think should be a basic move.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of... No, that's what we're here for. That actually makes a lot of sense. And it's funny, like the Berimbolo is something that I haven't even gone that into, because like I kind of... What you said sort of makes sense to me, to where it's like, if I'm going to, I would need to invest in that whole game. And it's not just in my head, I'm like, okay, I'd need to not only learn the Berimbolo, but I'd also need to learn how to then come up into the leg drag and like really have that nailed down. And then I'd also need to understand like the crab ride position. So in my head, I'm like, fuck, this is a lot to bite off here. And I'm probably going to need some time. So that does make sense, but it is such a, like a fundamental and high percentage move that, you know, you can base an entire game on. And I'm pretty sure you were telling me at some point that like in your purple belt, like that was your game, was like that Berimbolo type game.
Yeah. Well, it's coming back actually, believe it or not. So Ooh. In my game, that's mostly what I'm working on at the moment, is mixing the Berimbolo with the leg lock, stuff. So
okay.
And crab ride, yeah. So some interesting leg entanglements. But yeah, as a
brown belt. Are you talking no gi or gi?
Yes. Yeah. So I actually used to, if you had asked me a year ago whether
I'm pretty sure Berimbolo is a good
whether Berimbolo is a good game to play no gi, I probably would have said not really. It is harder. It's like you've taken the training wheels off. In the gi, you can climb, right? You've got like grips, and you can go like from here to here to here. Whereas no gi, you've got to find a way from the hips to the shoulders. It's like a long,
and you
cover.
And like, I feel like the grips that you can get, and like the leg drag to me always seems like the bailout plan. If like the Berimbolo isn't going the way that you sort of wanted to, it's like you can just use the gi and like sort of turn it into a leg drag. But in no gi, there's none of that. Like,
it's much harder to do something like that. Yeah, it's all harder no gi, but there's actually, I'm playing with it a lot. There's ways you can make it work, I guess is what I'd say. There's you've got to make adaptations, I should say. If you had asked me a year ago, I probably would have said, "Oh, don't bother. It's a bit too slippery, a bit too hard." So, yeah, it's interesting that too.
Are you doing that it off like, you don't have to give away too many secrets if you don't want, we can talk about it later, but yeah. Are you doing it off
my
like
plan, a, my plan is that people can't stop it even if they know what I'm doing, so
well that's the, all right. that's the ideal. Are you doing it with like a
funny thing?
Oh, sorry.
The funny thing is when they do block it, it usually gives me the leg locks easier, so I think they're gonna have to start choosing one or the other, which is nice. I think most people will choose to keep their legs away and give me the back take options. But
yeah. We'll see. So are you doing it off like an underhook De La Riva type situation?
Not as much. I'm still actually mostly when I'm going for the Berimbolo, it'll be from De La Riva Nogi and the waiter, you know, waiter guard.
Yeah.
Position. So, they actually link quite well together. And then, in and off the 50-50 as well. So if I can get to K guard, so basically when I'm in 50-50, if someone's starting to free their knee, so starting to escape the leg lock, that you can kind of spin under the crab ride and then you can continue on your
leg lock journey.
So it does kind of all link in with that leg lock game.
And then you could go to like the waiter position from like half guard if you want to, if you started in half guard, right?
Yes, you can go half guard to waiter. You can go, you often De La Riva to waiter. Sometimes you go for the Berimbolo and the person comes up and you're in the waiter position. And then that waiter leads back into the Berimbolo and kind of that crab ride entry. So,
yeah, right.
It's been good. And it's actually improved my back takes as well. Obviously, the Berimbolo, I kind of think of the Berimbolo as a leg first back take. Like you're kind of starting low on their body and you got to climb up. Whereas a lot of back takes, you're kind of starting with the seatbelt, you're starting with the upper body, and then you've got to get your legs in. We're kind of going almost in reverse to some extent. So it kind of has fixed, not necessarily fixed, but improved on some parts of my back take game too.
Yeah, right. So the point I was sort of getting at before is I think that it would be very hard for somebody, like let's say you didn't have this ADCC success and you were Lockyagi at Melbourne, you know, St Kilda, and you're the same level of coach, you've got the same jiu-jitsu mind, and you've got the same you know, everything you do is the same just without the medals, and you want to push that argument of like, hey, you guys shouldn't be listening only to the guys that compete. Yeah. It's a really hard sell, but I think that I think that it might be one of, you know, like when we look down the track, maybe one of your bigger contributions to jiu-jitsu is like you were able to kind of do both. Like I think that if you took away the competitive success, like your jiu-jitsu brain is still the shit, and you know, you're still able to come up with these the just immense amounts of detail, and like the content that you put out it's honestly ridiculous. Like from me, that like I make content and I look at it, I'm just like, fucking hell, like there is a lot in there. And that's just the production side of things, let alone the study and the hours that you put into the gym. It's honestly an insane body of work. And then, you know, you couple that with the competition thing. So I think that it's really cool. And you're in a unique position that, you know, you can say like, hey, I get it, you know, it's a hard sell to just when you hear someone that doesn't have any competition success saying that they have these world class, you know, I guess you could say like lectures and education. But you know, the fact that you've been able to do both, it kind of validates that theory a lot more.
Yeah, I think it's quite hard to, I don't think what I do as a coach is anything particularly special. Like I think, as in like, I think there's plenty of people who have as much detail. I think it's probably somewhat unique in that I'm someone who competes at a high level but also runs a gym. So I think obviously there's people who compete at a high level that run classes, but I think it's different when you run your own gym to running classes, because you have to, I have to think beyond just like, what am I teaching today? But actually like, how am I, like, what's the overall,
how are you facilitating?
How can I better make people who walk in the gym become good grapplers? You know, so I have to think like when they're from their first class through to, you know, what should people be learning at first? What should they be learning as a white belt? What should they be learning as a blue belt, purple belt? And so I think just having that perspective on it probably helps a lot as a coach. And there's obviously lots of coaches. Like, that's most coaches that own gyms, right? That's everyone. But then a lot of them aren't actually actively competing, especially at a high level. I think I just try to, you know, I've always tried to think of a jiu-jitsu kind of as like a computer program to some extent, like an if then, you know, like if this happens, then I'm going to do this. If this, you know, like which is basically, you know, we're building a system really, but like, you know, you got a position you like, and there's a bunch of possible scenarios. And I suppose for me, if someone can understand not just the linear, like the linear technique is important. Like, do you hit all the steps on the technique you're doing, but also do you understand when that technique's not going to work? For example, I'm going for an underhook and they block my, you know, my shoulder, you know, now I know the underhook's not going to work. Do I have an answer for that? You know, because you should. So I always tried to look for what those key points are that change the direction of where you want to go. And I think that's actually one thing a lot of people like about my coaching, is I kind of give a bit of direction beyond the technique. Like, I will go for this move, but only under these circumstances, and I will change it if this happens, you know, as opposed to here's 10 ways to pass the guard with no context on when or why I'd use either any of those 10. That's kind of hard. But if I go, this is how I pass guard, this one way, but if this gets blocked, then I'm going to try this way, you know, and then I'm going to try this way. That's a lot more digestible. And I think that's how you think when you're actually rolling, you know, you're trying to do a move and you're like, shit, they blocked my shoulder. You know, I got to do something else. Or like, how do I deal with that? You know, so you're kind of in the moment doing your move, and you need to be like, oh, okay, time to change strategy.
I think that one of the things that I've always been more attracted to than techniques themselves was just overall concepts. And that's been, you know, the thing for me. Like, and I actually get hit up constantly by people that I know that have actually started doing jiu-jitsu. And, you know, I'll sort of give them some breakdowns and stuff, and they're like, oh, what technique should I learn? I'm like, I pretty much don't really want to show you a technique. Like, I feel like maybe the right way to do a rear naked choke or something is probably like a really good submission to show somebody. But all I try and do with people is just literally just explain objectives. Like, if I'm here, my objective is to do this. So it's like, if you're in a sitting down and I'm standing up, if I can get my foot essentially past your hip and my knee past your hip, then I am like in control of you. If your feet are in between like my feet and your hips, then you're in control of me more so. So it's like trying to just really, I think that a lot of people that I even come across that are like deep into their white belt still just feel like they don't even know what they should be doing. And in my head, it's a very simple set of just objectives. And to me, it's like, you know, I've seen guys come into the gym that they're just really athletic and they just get it. They're just like, well, I'll just pin your legs down. And then when you push on my shoulders, I'm going to shrug that off and then put all my weight on top of you. And it's like somebody that's a complete noob can, you know, pass a blue belt guard or something like that, just pure physicality. And it's like, there's no technique there. They just kind of understand what they need to be doing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think we've had a few people come, you know, I think of different personalities. We've got some, I do think in the end, understanding, well, I mean, I think actually from the start, really, but if you can understand how and why the technique you're doing works, so like you say, the objective, and also understanding like what is the key point that makes this work, because then you can kind of sometimes something weird happens. Yeah, you're like, something weird happens, you're like, oh, okay, if I just try and keep their shoulders flat, however I do that, you know, you could do it a totally different way than what you originally planned.
Yeah,
and that can sometimes make the move still work. So I think that's I think that's kind of a prerequisite to also teaching. I think a linear, or it doesn't have to necessarily be linear, but I think teaching the technique is important as well, in that people should learn the feel of what it feels like doing it right. And I think that's why, like, you know, a lot of people, I think, improve fast, do quite a bit of drilling, especially early on, just because they get a good feel for like, okay, I block here. They see the sequence, like, okay, I've got to control the hip, control the upper body, put my knee to the ground and pass. But then I see some people who are pure, like, you know, will just focus on the details of a technique, and then they tend to get really good fast, but I feel like they plateau. They plateau at a certain level, because at a certain level, jiu-jitsu starts getting there's too much gray, you know, like people are going to block. They're going to block your leg. They're going to block this, they're going to block that. They're going to move left and right, that you actually have to be feeling and applying concepts and understanding or how the move you're trying to do works, so you can adapt and change. So I do think both are useful. I think long-term, the conceptual side ends up having the bigger impact. Like right now, I'll drill if there's a move I feel uncomfortable doing. You know, if I'm like, okay, I'm trying this move, I've only, you know, recently started doing it, and it doesn't feel like anything feels right, then I'll get some reps in to just get that feeling. But I'll learn a lot more by just like troubleshooting and trying to understand a little bit more about the context of when and where and what I'm trying to achieve with the grips I'm using. So that tends to play a lot more now. But I think right from the start, that can be good as well. I think they go hand in hand, right? You need to learn the techniques, but also the hows and whys and when.
Yeah. We've gone back and forth a couple of times, like on my little geek marathons that I'll do with jiu-jitsu. And like, you know, I've sort of looked at, you know, drawing different flow charts to sort of talk about the, you know, you say if someone does this, then go to this, and try to like, I guess, create a real, I guess it speaks to that room analogy that I used, you know, the last time that we spoke, where I sort of want to just have like this big room of jiu-jitsu, and I can kind of like look around the walls at all of like my options. And I wonder, like, I've been listening to a bunch of these scientific debates and podcasts around like the hard problem of consciousness, and these guys that are trying to actually create these very simple formulas that can actually provide like a mathematical model of what consciousness is. And I wonder that if I'll send you some links, it's super interesting. But I wonder if, you know, I could not recite it at all because it's like deep mathematical stuff, but the concept behind it actually makes sense, is that you've got these variables and then you've got these functions within these variables, and then it basically, you run that program and then it can sort of go off. I wonder if there is a way in which like jiu-jitsu could be mapped and programmed in the future using, you know, because it really is, and your DVDs do such a great job of illustrating this, is it really is this step-by-step kind of thing. And it's like different inputs create different options, and then the follow-up input as a result of that. So it's all essentially like this model of consciousness is, you've got like experience, action, and perception. And they're like these three kind of nodes in which all of the model of consciousness can be made. And then there's different functions on each one of these axes. And it's like, it's, yeah, literally this six sort of part formula. So I just wonder if like, I wonder if jiu-jitsu could ever be mapped in that sense that you could, you know, essentially create a computer program that had these, you know, locked in variables based on known knowledge. And I mean, knowing that you're a computer programming geek, I wonder if it's possible.
Oh, I'm definitely not very good at it at all.
Have you ever thought about it in the future?
Yeah. I mean, I've actually thought, you know how they've got the, so basically, I actually think like an AI thing would be interesting.
Yeah.
Like what they've done with chess. Obviously chess is a very, it's very easy to teach a chess board, like the chess rules and so on. They're very static. I think like teaching a machine, like what a human body is and how, like which ways it bends and which ways it doesn't and how it all moves together and like blood flow to the brain and so on. Like all these, I guess, variables that would apply to jiu-jitsu. But I can definitely envisage a feeding like a human body, like all of the anatomy and biomechanics into like an AI machine, and then making it fight another one in the rules of jiu-jitsu. Obviously in chess they got to the point where computers could beat humans, but then like I think they had this newer one, there's a newer Google one. It must have been like a year or two ago, but basically it's beating the chess masters and even beating the best other computer programs, and it's just AI. And they didn't tell it anything. They just started with, these are the rules of chess, and made it play against itself like millions of times.
Yeah.
And each time it would learn things. And then they'd play it against the other enhanced, you know, the other machines and other humans or whatever. And this AI one was using strategies no one had ever seen before. No one, like moves that didn't make sense.
Yeah.
They didn't even make sense why they're doing it, but it clearly it's just like worked out these things that work better than what we currently have. I'd be amazed to see if you could do that. I don't know if it can, but if you could do that in jiu-jitsu, and you know, what weird moves would come out that don't exist in the real world. But you'd obviously, is it too much to ask to have it so like, you know, could you feed in like a match getting slipperier as you get more sweaty and all that sort of stuff? I suppose if you had enough variables, you could, like, in a good enough understanding of it. But
I think that, that's probably really far down the track. But I think that what exactly the way you just explained the chess scenario with the AI, I think that could be conceivable in jiu-jitsu without really having to biohack the, or like, you know, ingest the biological information. I feel like if you just almost created like rules and guards and different things and different reactions that would stop, like, you know what I mean, that and somebody re-pummeling an arm, you know, and it's like, you could, it just plays it, so you just get it to play jiu-jitsu over and over again. And I mean, maybe it could be so simple to start with, like, this is closed guard, this is the options available in closed guard, and then for the bottom player, and this is the options that are available for the top player. And then if you use the same the way that they use this model of consciousness, it's like a very simple formula of like, this is the action, this is the perception of the action, and this is the experience, this is a perception of the experience, and then perception of the experience creates an action that then influences, you know, so it goes in this kind of circle. I mean, maybe it is not that crazy to think that jiu-jitsu could be programmed, and yeah, maybe you just start on this like micro scale of using essentially closed guard, because there is a finite amount of options and available from bottom and top. And I wonder, and there's actually, have you ever heard of a guy called Lex Fridman?
I've heard of, what's he?
He's been on Rogan before, and he's an AI kind of expert dude. And he's actually a jiu-jitsu black belt. And I feel like if there's any, like, he's probably had these crazy sort of thoughts about it. But I feel like if anyone's got, you know, like a really deep framework based on, you know, really breaking down and, like you said, that the troubleshooting side of what you do with your instructionals. Yeah. I mean, that you probably have some kind of skeletal outline of, you know, guards.
I suppose for me, it's never perfect, as in, like, there's always going to be
outliers.
I think you can, yeah, and you can, I think you can get it to a, like, obviously from the instructionals, I think if you follow exactly everything said in the instructions, I think it can get you very good. There's always, like, little tiny things that are almost not worth teaching in an instructional because it's so, it's so, you know, like, such a small situation that can occur in, like, a very rare circumstance. But, which I think you just kind of develop the feel for over time. And yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that I don't think you could make a
perfect,
I don't think you could ever make an instructional that just by following exactly what they say in the instructional, you'll be, you know, you're going to go and beat Gordon Ryan. But I think you can get someone to, like, you know,
oh, what? That's what the whole reason I started talking about this. I wanted you to tell me that I could beat Gordon.
Well, I mean, I think what I should say is you could get to the level where you could beat a Gordon Ryan if you follow an instructional and you are also, like, working out what feels good for you and what doesn't, and your own little variants of that. And to beat Gordon Ryan, you probably also have to be incredibly gifted as well.
yeah, because that's the thing, man. Talent is, like, this ultimate motherfucker when it comes to jiu-jitsu, because, you know, like, if you want to be in that 1%, like, there just is something that you have to have that, like, can't be trained. And like you said, you know, the most technical dude that is at, you know, Worlds might be knocked out in round one. It's just not, it's not always this, you know, the guy that has the most wins.
Yeah, I think jiu-jitsu is good compared to most other things in life, I think, in that, like, you get more rewarded for your hard work than you necessarily do in other things. You know, I think if you played soccer, you could train 10 times as much as everyone else in your soccer team, but your just natural potential is going to play a bigger role in how good you end up. Whereas in something like jiu-jitsu, if you train 10 times as much as everyone else, you're much more likely to be better than them. Still, your natural potential is going to influence how much better, or if you're only slightly better, or you end up being 20 times better than them because you're already going to be good. And now you're, you know, but I feel like you really do see reward for hard work in jiu-jitsu. But obviously at the elite level, that starts to, you know, when at the elite level, when everyone's doing it, everyone's putting in hard work, then it starts to come back towards natural potential, having a larger influence. So I think for, like, your average gym, you know, your average gym role, your, how much hard work you're willing to put in and how you approach jiu-jitsu will have a huge, like, that's going to be probably absolutely going to be the primary determinant of whether you're going to be one of the best guys, if not the best guy in the gym, you know, long-term. Whereas for an absolute elite top of the top division, it's probably a bit more complex than that.
I would think that what you're saying really does describe why people go so all in on jiu-jitsu, because in 2-something years that I've been training, I have got out of sight better than the person that walks in day one. And in the exact same interval that I've been riding motocross this whole time, I'm not that much better. Like,
you can have, like, a guy that comes in and they're just good at, you know, riding motocross. Yeah, that's, and I think we're talking about sports, but I also think that applies to, you know, I think it, like, at high school, I was decent at math, but, you know, you'd have the one kid that's just like, oh yeah, you know, I get that. You learn it day one and they understand it immediately. Whereas for you, like, you have to actually put in a lot of work, you know. Like, even schooling-based things, I think, and, you know, and probably most aspects of life, some people have to work really hard to get the same result as just to stay like on par with someone else. Whereas jiu-jitsu, you really see you see the fruits of your labor, so to speak.
Yeah, and that seems to be like, obviously, yeah, the level in which, you know, if it's a scale, you know, some person might end up at 800x on the scale and someone might end up at 1400 in the same time. But like, even if you're the person that's at 800x, like, that's still such a remarkable difference. And there's not many things in your life that you would be able to do consistently for 2 years and have the kind of transformation that jiu-jitsu would give you. I personally have not been involved in anything like that. Maybe the podcast, but again, that's probably something that, you know, happens even way before you even start, based on, you know, filming and stuff like that. But in terms of just jiu-jitsu, there's been nothing that I've ever done that in 2 years I've been so dramatically different, like unrecognizably different than the person at day one.
Yep. It's good.
But I think that's the case for most people, you know, like if you do stick it to that 2 year mark, like there's nobody that is going to be, you know, let's pick 2 years as the number. Like there's nobody that would be consistently training for 2 years that wouldn't experience a very similar thing, I would say.
Yeah, there's definitely, I've definitely seen people, you know, just as a coach, there's some people learn fast and some learn slow, but anyone who's consistent will get better, which is good, which is really good. I think about, I don't know, basketball. I tried to play basketball. I played basketball when I was young. I think I was okay skill wise, but you just get a tall kid would come along and not much I could do. I'm probably playing that up. You know, obviously if I was, I would have to be like exceptionally good.
Yeah.
Just to be able to, like, I'd have to be like a one in, you know, 10, one in a thousand to, so that I could go against this tall kid and actually, you know, make
snap
him look like a fool.
Snap his ankles.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's the real answer.
Yeah. That, you were like, you know what? If I can't snap their ankles on the court, I'm just going to go do it on the mats. You win that, you get third at ADCC, and then you went on basically a world tour of seminars. And is there anything, like, obviously you'd done seminars before, but this was just completely different. Like, literally everyone's like, show me how you heel hooked everybody. And, you know, there was such a crazy demand, and you and Liv literally traveled the world for, it felt like 6 months almost. What was that experience like? And is there any interesting takeaways that you, like, I guess, learned about jiu-jitsu overall by just seeing such a varied populace of people who were trying to get better?
The experience of the travel or the experience of the seminars in particular?
Just the whole thing, because, man, like, your life literally was different. Like, happened... And then 6 months, your life just was completely different. And then it was, you know, literally half a year until you got back to some level of normal.
Yeah, well, and that was kind of forced on us, wasn't it, with COVID? Yeah, probably true. Still be doing a seminar tour. So, I mean, for me, it just made sense to me financially, like, you know, to make the most of a, you know, like, I don't know what's going to happen at next ADCC, but... I know that I definitely got a lot of hype from this one. So why not, you know, try to maximize 100%. That and, you know, do seminar tours. And so we had a ridiculous, it was basically, it would be in a new country or city, pretty much. Like, I'd be traveling Europe and be in it would be fly to Germany, you know, fly to Berlin, do a seminar, fly to Poland the next day, do a seminar, fly, you know, it'd be almost like fly in the morning, teach that night and then have some hotel to stay at and then do the next thing, you know, the next day. So it's incredibly tiring. It was nice having Liv there just to you know, share the responsibility a bit, you know, so like someone looking after, like, not understanding how we're getting to the hotel and I don't have to be stressing about that and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Just on top of the, you know, it's a pretty, you know, whenever you go on a flight, you got to leave usually you got to leave at least an hour. You got to allow about an hour's time to get there just in case, you know, something happens. And then you got an hour till you get on the plane, and then you got to fly, and then you got to get off, and you got to find a taxi, you get to your hotel, unpack all your stuff. And then by the time you do that, it's pretty much time to, you know, you got an hour until the seminar starts. So you got to, you know, and then it's often, you know, you meet, you know, the people are excited to have you there, so they want to hang out, and you,
yeah,
which is cool. Actually, I really like, you know, that's probably the best part of it, is actually meeting people in from different parts of the world that are training and doing their own thing and running their own gyms, and, you know, that's really cool. So catch up with them, do the seminar, usually go out for dinner, get back to the hotel, sleep, and same thing again the next day. So it's definitely full on. So we would usually do like a kind of two week seminar tour, and then come back for about 2 weeks and then go again. That was about how it was working. But yeah, I mean, for me, it was, I quite enjoy the travel and so on and meeting people, but I also, you know, in terms of my own training, I much prefer having consistent training partners,
yeah,
to work with. So it's good to, what was it? Probably in terms of like rolling, like, and so on, what I got out of that. I mean, it's good. You're rolling with like every, you know, on those tours, every single person's rolling differently. You know, usually at your gym, you kind of, I'm rolling with, you know, I'm going to roll with Mikhail, and I know what moves he's going to do, and he knows what moves I'm going to do. And it's, you know, who gets the, you know, who's able to pull off their thing. I roll with Craig. I know what he's going to do. He knows what I'm going to do. But when you just have someone across the room from you that you shake hands with, and you're like, I don't know, you know, they're going to pass under my legs, around, through, they're going to jump for a armbar. I have no idea. So it kind of, it's good like that. You kind of make sure, I think it makes your game, ready for anything, you know, not being like, not expecting your opponent to do something. It's like, okay, I've got to force my game to happen. And obviously the roles are mixed. Like, you know, some people roll really well. Some people, everyone's watching and you're rolling in a seminar and they want to go crazy and try and tap out the, you know, test themselves against the, which I don't mind that either, actually. Like, I want to get training in too.
Yeah.
I don't really want to get tapped out in front of everyone, but I'm aware that that can or will happen one day. So that's how it is. But it's, yeah, I mean, overall it's pretty full on, but it's really good, you know. And I like going different, especially going to play, you know, we went to Turkey, for example, and, you know, went to Rome and ate really nice food and meet the people running jiu-jitsu gyms. And you get to learn that, you know, it's, I think one of the main things is like just how widespread jiu-jitsu is and how big it's gotten and how big it's going to become. You know, it's, like, I think it's still in its infancies compared to where it will be in 10, 20 years, but it's already starting to be huge.
Yeah, that was definitely something that I was curious about. Like, did it give you a different appreciation for the scale of jiu-jitsu? And I guess, did you bring anything back from that? You know, you're just like this jiu-jitsu vagabond for 6 months going to, you know, literally everywhere. And I know the way that your mind works, and, you know, what, I'm curious to know if there was any kind of takeaways like that.
I mean, I think with the scale of it, and I think there's been a big shift. Like, I think with a lot of the recent instructionals that are out there and the way people, I think I've seen a huge shift in the way people approach their training. Things that I used to, you know, I used to say like, hey guys, let's specific training, you know, for example. You know, and that used to be like, they used to be like, whoa, like, that's a weird way to, you know, people were like shocked that I would have this training methodology. And I think that's more normal now, at least. It depends on where you train, but, you know, like, I think training methodology is getting better. People are listening to some of the more intelligent minds in the grappling world and taking on, the technical approach and the right training methodology. And I think that means now that you're going to start seeing more and more high level competitors coming out from anywhere. You know, you don't know where the next best grappler is going to be coming from. You know, it used to be basically, if you're not coming out of Brazil, there's no point. Now it's Brazil or America, and it's already started to, you know, now you've got these really good grapplers coming out of Norway.
Yeah.
And obviously, we've had Australia's had some good success. There's, you know, the UK. There's kind of worldwide, I think, you know, I'm just waiting until Russia and all those Dagestanis that do wrestling decide that jiu-jitsu is a good sport to train, because we're going to be in a lot of trouble when they do that.
That was,
I'll be well retired by then, but yeah.
That was literally, I wrote down, because I remember, I don't know whether you it was like an Instagram thing or something you said on a podcast, but I was actually going to ask you, like, the Khabib call that you made, like, do you think that if Khabib went to ADCC, for example, like, how do you think he would do against, you know, let's say someone like yourself, like, you're very similar weight, similar, like, body sort of proportions. Like, do you think that with the level that jiu-jitsu is at right now, that if, let's say, you fought Khabib at 77 kilos, do you think that the technical difference, and obviously rule sets make a difference, but in that technical sense, like, do you think that Khabib could be effective against somebody at a high level like yourself?
I think he's an outstanding athlete. So I think if you had Khabib spending a few years, like, if you said, like, you know, you've got 3 years to prepare for ADCC, like, we're going to try and make you, he's already got the wrestling, which, you know, I do consider ADCC a somewhat of a wrestling competition. So he's going to be, anyone he can take to overtime, he might beat. If that makes sense. Like, if he can last 10 minutes without getting submitted and without losing a point, just staying on
which
top.
Or probably he could, really.
I think he would have a decent chance, but I also think MMA is quite different to jiu-jitsu. Like, you, on your back in jiu-jitsu, in MMA, you can't open, like, I can't, you can't open up a lot. Like in MMA, if you start opening up, you get punched by Khabib, you know, whereas, like, basically in grappling, you can open, I could spam leg attack entries and one of them has to hit, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think he would win ADCC if I can put it that way. I think he would most likely lose round one in ADCC, if not round two. But at the same time, I think just as an athlete, like, and having that wrestling background, and what I'd say is a style of wrestling that seems to translate well to grappling, like to groundwork too, I think he would not take too long to be very formidable against some of the better guys. You know, like, I think I would pick him over everyone else in my division in a takedown, like, purely, you know, wrestling. You know, obviously JT Torres took everyone down, but I would still pick Khabib over JT Torres from a wrestling point of view. But I think once it hit the ground, with the differences in how the groundwork's approached, I imagine he would struggle unless he actually specifically trained that style for a while.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. It was it was interesting. Like, I can't remember where I saw it, but I was just like, I wonder. Like, it would be.
I was really at my Khabib and Dustin Poirier post.
Yeah, maybe. I had
a bit of a clickbaity title on that, and that was that's hilarious. If you go and read the comments of that, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
So I wrote something like, I think the title was, you know, like, I was basically, you know, just, it was basically like a video on, like, how I would approach in that scenario, like, trying to finish a guillotine. And I think I wrote something like how Dustin Poirier could have finished something, which clearly worked for views because, like, it got shared a lot. But there's so many people got on that and they're like, you know, oh, who is this guy? You know, like,
what is
Khabib smash him? Don't you know that Khabib would never tap ever, not even in training? All these sort of things. There's like, I think there's like 500 comments on it. So it might be, it made me think it's probably a good idea to make those videos just because people comment on them and they get more views and that actually helps. I probably shouldn't use the clickbait titles. But anyway.
I'll clickbait this, don't worry. It sucks, like, it sucks, man. I've got it in, I work pretty hard on the YouTube thing, obviously, and it's just like, videos do not get watched unless it's clickbait. Can't
absolutely
say it enough.
Yeah,
I'm very sorry, but Don't be mad at me. It's like, don't hate the player, hate the game. YouTube's the fucking game. Yeah. Be mad at YouTube. They just, nothing gets seen.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, it's actually not clickbait, but I knew it would be something that would be,
yeah, I suppose clickbait's the wrong word.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you want them to click on it. So yeah, but, I mean, my most recent video I put up on YouTube was, on why you shouldn't hip escape for open guard retention.
Yeah.
And I knew people would, you know, that would be a topic of fierce debate, but I actually genuinely believe that everything I said in there is correct. So I don't think it's a misleading title, but, I knew it would, I deliberately put, you know, I could have said something, you know, I could have put a more mild title, but I knew, yeah, I knew if I said, put it like that, like you should, you know, why you should never hip escape for guard retention. I knew that would get people clicking on it and going, geez, that's an interesting, you know, that's an interesting thing to say. And yeah, so I bet you got to do it, like you said.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
We don't have to, but if you want to get more views, you got to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, 100%. It frustrates the shit out of me because it's like you can work as hard as you want on like great content, but great content, unfortunately, just doesn't stand alone in this era of media.
Some of my best videos on YouTube, I think, are, you know, like as in like best content, I'm like, geez, this is like really good details. People are going to like it. And I'll be like, you know, passing the half guard 1.1, controlling the near side leg or something like that. And like no one clicks it. Yeah. Like it sounds boring, even though it's like such a, what I think is like a clearly overlooked area of, you know, with all these details that people miss and, you know, but I've noticed that if you don't word the title right, and even the, I think even having a good little visual, I've started just taking a screenshot and putting it in Photoshop and making some sort of weird background on the image and a couple of words like why you shouldn't hip escape or something on it, you know, something like that. Just, I don't know why people seem to think it's a more professionally made, or I don't know. It must just give the image that like if a lot of thought has gone into the actual presentation of it, then it must be a more thoughtful video, which seems somewhat counterintuitive, but yeah.
I think also it's just a slot machine effect. I think it's just like ding, 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 like bright lights flashing. Yeah. You know what I mean? I think that there's just a thing, like so much of us, I think, I mean, on like a deeper level, like we're just still monkeys. Like, and there's just so much shit that you can do so easily to just hack the monkey mind. And bright, super cut, like I don't like fucking bright blue or like, you know what I mean? Like the brightest neon blue. That's not a color I like, but that's my whole YouTube channel because ding, 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 ding. Like, you know what I mean? It's got bells and whistles and emojis and it's like whatever attracts people's attention. Like all you're trying to do with the whole thumbnail thing and clickbait is just tug on that monkey brain, you know, just like attack that monkey brain and then try and hit them with some good content. But it's like you don't have a chance until you can really hit that monkey brain, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's something I'll keep working on. I need to hire someone to be the clickbait writer.
I could definitely help you with some thumbnail templates for sure.
Yep.
Like it's okay, cool. Yeah, we could definitely make that happen. But yeah, it's just like it's so insanely important. Like I don't even look at views on my videos as much as I look through my click-through rate. So whatever my click-through rate is on my thumbnail, like that's what I look at. That's a judge of a video. If it's like 11%, then I've got a really good video on my hands. And if it's like 15%, that shit is going viral.
I should what I should do is go back to some of my old videos and put a new thumbnail on.
100%.
And then just see what happens to the view. That's actually a very good idea.
Man, I'll help you pick a couple of those videos, like two or three. Send me the screenshot of the video. And then I'll make your thumbnails and just see if it
can you change a difference. Can you change the title as well?
Yeah. Yeah.
You can?
Yeah. Clickbait everything, mate.
Maybe I'll do that.
Oh, it's all insane. Right, cool. It's insane. Like I mean, it's unfortunate that that's how it is, but you sort of just can't. And like a lot of my content, like I pretty much, like I think this year, just this year, we've had 24 million impressions on my YouTube channel. Yeah, and like you've awesome. probably had more, to be honest. And
impressions. How do we find that out?
Just going
to go on right now.
Yeah, going to your analytics. But
bring that up, Jamie. So, whatever they say.
Yeah, look that up, Jamie. but yeah, so your reach, it's under your reach tab in your analytics.
Yep.
And then it'll show you it should say impressions. And so like you'll have impressions and then you'll have views. So impressions is the amount of time YouTube's shown your thumbnail to the audience. And then your views are obviously people that have clicked through. So then, you know, the higher.
Okay,
so
I'll read 2 million impressions. So not as many as 2 million. Yeah.
When was that? What period's that though?
Oh, wait. No, last 28 days. Okay.
Yeah. You've got way more.
Do you want me to go lifetime?
Just go 365.
I went. Okay. Last 365 days. 30.3 million.
Yeah. So, and then if you go to your views now of your like overall views in that 365. So like essentially YouTube has shown your content to 30 million people or 30, it's shown your thumbnails 30 million times. And the amount of views you've got is the click-through rate to those videos. So like you really want to bridge that gap between your impressions and your views essentially.
I've only got 5.4%.
Yeah. So that's like average. So if you start to then like my good ones, like good videos that I've got will be like 11 to like 15. That's what I'm sort of chasing. And then higher.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
So like you just wanna what you want to do is find like a style that is gonna just gradually up your click-through rate, and then you'll start to see like, oh, this color works better, or this title works better, or works better for, you know. So but yeah, I mean there's so many fucking crazy, like when you talk about the clickbait, like that's why they do that shit.
Yeah for sure. It's I mean even I get, you know, sometimes something comes up and I'm scrolling through a social media thing and I'm like, I find myself clicking. I'm like,
you know,
I don't really want to know the answer to this. Like, it's just a stupid question that I don't want to know. For some reason now, I keep getting these suggestions coming up of, you know, now I keep getting the, you know, like there's a croc, you know, hunting a boar or something, like, you know, some sort of like wildlife thing. I'm obviously like, one or two have come up and I've been like, oh, is the croc going to get the boar? And then, you know, now there's like, you know, any kind of wildlife, they obviously think I'm one of those people that likes that. So there we are, which I actually kind of do. So they, to be fair, they, I like watching those nature documentary sort of things. So
there was a video that come up recently. And I mean, I'm just pretty, like my YouTube is like basically philosophy, like anything philosophy or like nature of mind, consciousness, all that shit. Like that's pretty much where I'm at the moment. And then there'll be like jiu-jitsu and then motocross highlights. So like I'm operating in a pretty narrow window. But this video come up and it was like this 93-year-old dude's what he actually is a philosopher, and he wrote about death. He wrote a book about death. I think he said he wrote like 8 or 9 books in his life. And in this video, it was one of the most raw and like touching videos I've ever watched. But he sort of starts this video and he's like, I've written 8 or 9, I've had 8 books published in my 97 years. And I'd like to think that on all of these topics, I really knew what I was talking about, except the book I wrote about death. And like he just spent like this 12 or 14 minute video, just really like, it was insane. I'll shoot you a link. But the funniest thing was like every single YouTube comment was people saying like, man, I actually feel good that this come up in my recommended, like I feel like I'm on the right path in life. And like everybody was saying the same shit, like wow, if YouTube's sending me this, I must be starting to figure it out.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's fine. They know, but man, there's people way smarter than I'll say me. I don't want to lump you in that basket, but there's people way smarter than me that are figuring out how to keep us locked in.
Yeah, it's you really just get put in like a, I think it's like, you know, they figure out what you like and then they give you more of that and it just puts you more down your rabbit hole, you know? Mm. So you just end up whatever you're, I think that's why I'm obviously not the first person to think this, but it seems like that's going to be an issue in that it's going to make the world more divisive, you know, like if someone likes one side of politics, they get pushed more and more views that support that and less of the counter arguments and then same thing on the other side, which I think, it's going to be quite a divisive thing if it already is, but yeah.
Yeah, and then you add the fact that the platforms are so geared towards that negative bias. Like the videos that I've got videos on my YouTube channel that have like 100, 200,000 views on these segments. And they're the ones where I'm just getting fucking torched in the comments. Like that's the common denominator. Like a bunch of people, and there's this social proof that is, it seems like as soon as one person says like there'll be someone's like, what, who the fuck's this blue belt think he is talking about? You know what I mean? Then there's that guy. And then that gives this social proof where someone else is like, yeah, this fucking blue belt doesn't know shit. And then everybody gets in and then, and YouTube is just like, let's send this video out to people. And it's like, that's the common theme. And I think that even that's why you see like people build their whole style on that. You know, like you look at a guy like Chael Sonnen, he will just say this shit that will, you know, I guess like get people to call him out or to say he's a fucking idiot.
Say the same with Gordon Ryan, really, I think.
100%.
Yeah. I feel like Gordon Ryan does that. Yeah.
Have you?
I guess the sad thing is it seems to work, right? Like
it,
in terms of, it depends what you want, but like, you know, for Gordon Ryan, if he gains another, you know, 100,000 fans by acting a certain way, and loses 10,000, then like he might see that as a big plus, and he doesn't really care what people think apart from outside of his like close social group. You know, then that can be, can, you know, I think that's the same reason why people are going to trash talk in MMA and so on. Like it makes sense financially. Like I shouldn't, but I would much rather watch a fight that's like hyped up with people who are like, you know, talking crap to each other. I don't know why, but like for whatever reason, when I see that, I'm like, oh, I'm more excited about this fight than just turning on a UFC and watching two people fight like that. If there's no hype behind the fight, I don't get that excited about it for some reason.
Yeah. Do you think though, like with Gordon, do you think that he's made the sport better and more profitable? Like, let's say there's no Gordon Ryan. Do you think that ADCC was as big as it is this year? Do you think that there's the fight to wins that have the, you know, really good cards? Like, because I haven't been in the sport a super long time, only a few years, but I think it's visibly grown in front of me. And it's like, you have to say that Gordon Ryan is like the spearhead figure in the sport, and especially because he is so polarizing. And I think that now, like, people talking shit, like, that was the original problem that everyone had with Gordon, was like, he talks shit, he's disrespectful to the sport. And then now, like, those same people that were criticizing him back when I first got in the sport are all doing the exact same shit. And it seems like there's a lot of people that are, you know, like, these, the super fights are getting more, these fight to win cards, who's number one. Like, it sort of seems like, unfortunately, my question is, it unfortunate if a guy like that is actually doing something to grow the sport? Would you rather have the sport grow slow but with more like integrity, or it just grow, you know? Because at some point he's going to retire, and if he leaves the sport bigger than when he came in, he kind of did a good thing for the sport, right?
Yeah, I think you could definitely make that argument. I don't know how
what's the counter argument
about that? Like, yeah, I mean, the counter argument is that, like, you know, do we want the sport to grow for the sake of just growing the sport? But on the other hand, having, you know, like, yeah, he's obviously, there's young, impressionable people that think that the way Gordon Ryan acts is the way you should act. Especially he's online. It's actually much more mellow in person than he is online. Yeah. But yeah, he's like, you know, is kind of quiet, doesn't seem to, you know, doesn't like seem to stir people up nearly as much in person as he does online. But yeah, like, I mean, I suppose, like, if everywhere, you know, let's just imagine that this isn't combat sports, which seems to have more of that than anything else. But let's imagine that's in every field, you know, like, no matter what you watch on TV or whatever, but if everyone's acting like that to everyone and that becomes the norm, I don't think that's a good thing. So having one area, like, you know, in an area like jiu-jitsu, if that is leaning us towards more acting like that, then I don't think that's overall necessarily a good thing. But I mean, is that outweighed by more people getting into jiu-jitsu? Maybe. I mean, it probably makes a lot of sense from a personal level for Gordon Ryan to build up his profile and, you know, sell more instructionals and get more money for his super fights and all that. Like, that absolutely makes sense from an individual level. From a, I want jiu-jitsu to grow because it's awesome. Like, as in, like, I want more people to realize how good it is. But I don't necessarily think, like, I don't want more people to do jiu-jitsu for, you know, just because, like, I think jiu-jitsu is a good thing. But if I thought overall jiu-jitsu started having a negative impact on people's lives and the way they acted and so on, if I thought that outweighed the positives of it, I would probably think I'd be less inclined to want more people, you know, to want, like, jiu-jitsu to become more widespread. But I mean, I'm not, like,
it's a very hypothetical. It's a very hypothetical question. But
yeah, I mean, I'm taking it to a very big extreme, saying, like, you know, but I think that influence the way that kids act. You know, I don't. There might be no impact of that at all. You know, it could act that way, and in the end, like, most kids are gonna just, you know, like, people that follow him aren't really gonna change the way they act in there. I haven't looked at the research on how much someone's idol actually influences their behaviors, but I think he has grown. I mean, I do think, like, that has grown the sport in terms of popularity. I think, for whatever reason, like, especially those shows like Fight to Win and so on, and why everyone's wanting to watch more no-gi than gi at the moment, even though gi is probably more popular in terms of what's practiced in actual gyms. Everyone seems to want to watch no-gi matches, and I think that's probably a big part due to the ADCC and Gordon's influence.
Yeah. Yeah, you are right, though, when you say, like, because that is one of the things that I always try to do when it comes to, like, a complicated problem. It's like, okay, what's, like, the most extreme version of this question? Yeah. And I think that the same, like, a really good example of that is, like, when I was living in the US and people would talk about guns. And I'm like, all right, let's just extrapolate this out to the point where it's like, okay, so are you cool with every single person having a gun? So that doesn't make sense. All right, so then you kind of have to go the other way, because it's like, you can't really, you know what I mean? If your argument is like, oh, well, this person should have a gun, this person, then it's like, we're just going to get to the point where everyone has a gun. And then at that point, we're like, maybe that's not the right idea. So you kind of have to go back to where you started.
I suppose on both, usually for a lot of arguments, you can make you take it to the absurd almost on either level, and you can find something that's ridiculous, and then what you usually find by doing that is that somewhere in the middle is you know, like, some degree of trash talking is probably good. You know, if everyone in the sport just starts trash talking and, like, it's literally everywhere and that's all anyone does to promote a fight, I don't know if I like that direction of where it's headed like that. But I think if you've got the occasional person who's doing it and that builds up hype, but most people in the sport tend to play a more kind of respectful approach, then overall I think you could still say that jiu-jitsu's, you know, stands for good values, and, you know, it should be promoted more and so on. So
it makes sense. Good answer. I never really thought of it that much until then, but
yeah. Me either. So I might good. Change my mind tomorrow.
The last thing that we were talking about, I'd like to pick your brain a little bit more about, was my 52 classes in a month idea.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So yeah. Obviously, the first concern, don't get hurt, because it is that's a lot of training. But yeah. Like, let's say, you know, I come to you with that idea as a person that has the experience that you do. And obviously, let's play this game assuming that I'm not going to get injured and that I'm physically well prepared to deal with the task. What would you think is like, okay, so let's plan this thing out so that you get the most out of that experience. Like, because it is quite an extreme way to do training. Yeah. And essentially it would be just like a month long Thailand, you know, kind of experience.
Yep.
But you know, what could you see as like, what way would you tackle that? What's some of the things that you think you could get out of it? Is it even worth doing, you know, like as just a pure thought experiment, like what do you see in that?
I think for a few reasons, you would want to work multiple areas of your game per day. And not just do like a full week on X guard and then a full week on, you know, something else. I think there's a couple of reasons. The first would be, even just for injury's sake, having, you know, when you play X guard, if you did that all day, basically, then it's the same part of your body taking stress all day. Whereas like, you know, X guard compared to playing, you know, from the back, trying to choke from the back, then has different parts of your body taking different strains. So more likely to spread the load out and less likely for one structure to get overloaded and get injured.
Also, zero takedowns will be done in this month.
So you might want to.
Zero takedowns.
From a learning perspective, we know that a lot of the processing of what happened during the day and transforming that into improvement actually occurs as you sleep. So your brain kind of takes in this information, you sleep, and then you come in the next day better. And they've proven that like with video games and so on, like your little tasks that you try at it and you kind of reach a certain level and then you sleep and then they try it again the next day and it's jumped, you know, you've made a jump. So to me, doing, as long as you get enough exposure to it, you know, if you had like half an hour on X guard each day for a month, I think, or maybe an hour, you know, I haven't really thought about exactly how hour on X guard, let's say each day, but then you're getting your sleep at night and allowing the improvements to like consolidate in your brain and kind of you get the full 28 days of that rather than say doing a week on X guard and then a week on something else. So I would probably be picking a few areas of the game that you want to definitely improve on and make sure you're working them specifically each day. Then you could probably, given the volume you're looking for, you're going to have to be, it can't be all rolling, right? Like it's going to have to be drilling and it's going to have to be I think you need the drilling to be smooth, you know, nothing too. I think it all has to be kind of positions that just purely from the volume, it would have to be positions that aren't extremely taxing on the body, like you say with wrestling. You know, you're not going to wrestle.
No. I don't know how many.
52 days worth in a month. Maybe like working a, you know, making it, working your back attacks or back escapes might be a lot less taxing than some of the other things where you got to chase down a single leg and so on. I think probably if I had to actually structure like specific style, I'd probably like think work something from guard, some sort of guard, some sort of passing style, some sort of finishing style. And perhaps one other of the others. And I think like over a month, like having four things to work on would probably be sufficient. I don't know how much, it depends how much rolling you want to get in as well. You might, and I think you could probably mix it up each day, you know, like some days you don't roll, you just do specific training and drills. Mm. And another day you might just roll and kind of see how it's all actually integrating in the, like how well what you're practicing in isolation is actually transferring to your game as a whole.
Yeah.
And use those roles to kind of troubleshoot and go back and fix things. So yeah, that's right now. That's all I can think of. Was there any other parts that you had a thought about there that like in terms of how you would do it or how do you think you would approach it?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of, just because I've been injured this whole year, like I actually already wanted to have done it. It was sort of my plan because my sort of goal with it is that like, I get a lot of interest in people, like obviously like I don't have a jiu-jitsu channel, like it's way more skewed towards like just general interviews and then the sport that I'm normally covering is motocross. But like I get a lot of interest and I've had a lot of people that have started jiu-jitsu that listen to the podcast and I'd love to do something that could really just showcase like how hard it is. How much work just the average person puts into jiu-jitsu. Like, you know, for example, you know, like Shane, he's a guy, he's a 3-stripe brown belt. He's running his own academy. I mean, he did like 30 something rolls in a week before, you know, when he was getting ready for the state titles. And it's like, he's just a normal guy. Like, I mean, essentially jiu-jitsu is his job, but like he wouldn't consider himself an athlete. Like he still calls himself a hobbyist. So it's like the average dude that is very into jiu-jitsu works so insanely hard at this thing.
Yeah.
And I just would love to do something that showcases that, you know, the intensity of the training and the seriousness that people put in it. Mm. So I think that's probably my overall goal outside of even just getting better is I think it would be, you know, essentially it's a clickbaity fucking title, you know. Like,
but I think what would be cool... What would be cool would be to set up a little tournament at the start of, not a tournament, but like have like 4 guys you roll with and you try and beat them at the start. And then after the 28, after the year's worth of training in a month, roll with those same 4 people and see if you've made progress against them.
That would be cool. That would especially be cool against like high level guys.
Yeah.
And guys that...
I think actually if you had a mix, like if you had someone like at 1 blue belt, 1 purple, 1 brown and 1 black maybe or something, you know, like a mixing it up and seeing, cause I imagine you would improve a lot. It'd be interesting to see whether I do think I have a theory to some degree, which I don't think is proven, but I think... if you think about pain and how much pain you'd actually be in training that higher volume,
I think pain's
actually in some ways, actually in a lot of ways, pain is a way of saying like, don't learn that. You know, they do that in psychological experiments. Like the dog does something and they make it hurt.
Yeah.
So like, you know, they'll hit them or whatever they do, or, you know, zap them with a thing. And it stops the dog from, it actually like makes your brain learn not to do that.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you're so sore from training that you're showing up and it's actually hurting to train.
Yeah.
I wonder if it actually stops your brain from learning skills as well as if you're feeling fresh. So I wonder if you can get the same benefits by jamming all that training in, but getting really sore and potentially losing some of the...
like the motor neuron kind
the
of
actual, at yeah, the, like yeah. The, at like a, at the brain level of learning, like whether you're actually impeding that.
Yeah.
This is just a thought I've had in that only because like I used to train more and I actually train a bit less now. And I feel like I learn better now. Or at least I feel better when I show. I think like if you come up to training, you're feeling good, you want to be there, you're enjoying it, and you're like, yes, this is really good. I feel like I learn more than if I'm really sore and I'm like, oh, I would like a rest today, but I know I have to train. And, you know, like, so I do it anyway. And I feel like I don't get as much out of those sessions.
Mm.
And then I think if you did a year's worth in a month, you'd probably be pretty sore.
Yeah,
but it'd be very interesting to look at, actually.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I'd like to do, obviously, it's probably going to be when COVID's over, hopefully, in the sense that people can travel. But what I would like to do is invite people to come and spend a week. So, like, I'd get, like, Skin Man and be like, hey, man, come up, do the week. We'll live together. We'll do this training. And then, you know, do the podcast, talk about jiu-jitsu and, you know, that kind of thing. And then he'd be involved in, like, the content side of things. And then, you know, have a different person come. And then, you know, you'd sort of be kind of working with these, like, sort of different people. So it would be varied. But I'd want to try and structure it as well. But it'd be so hard to structure something when, like, you just wouldn't even know what your body would be able to sort of take, I guess.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're going to be at increased risk of injury for sure. Just like your training volume is going. I mean, I think you should first get, I think you probably should spend like 3 months building up your capacity before you would try something like that. Just like build up your baseline.
Yeah.
Level of training.
And then I think the recovery side of things.
Not too big of a spike.
Yeah, and the recovery side of things, like I feel like it would literally be a month of ice baths, you know, twice a day. you know, like,
A fair bit of your training could be stretching and so on as well, you know, just like
that's
still, you know, I think a useful part of training, but it's low impact on the body compared to doing all just classes, for example.
Yeah, and then I think that one of the other elements that I'd really, really like to do is film almost everything. Like, and I mean, it would be for content purposes, but I think that aside from the content, the learning itself, I mean, I watched the video that I posted of my my finals couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I've never really get to watch footage of me roll. I don't really know what I look like when I roll. I don't really know the techniques. And there was stuff that I looked and I was like, wow, that's really, really cool, to the point where I was like, I didn't even think of that. Like, I just did that. But then there was stuff where I was like, I obviously wasn't thinking there because I could have done a trillion other things. So I think that that would be something. I think that in my mind, the most beneficial thing that I could do in that month would be film and study all of the, not only just the roles, but the specific training and really to just see, you know, because like when we, like I said, when we, you know, the, I guess part one of this, it's so much of jiu-jitsu comes down to this like proprioception and this almost like involuntary correct movements of your limbs, because so much of it just isn't thought.
Good point on that, actually. I think, you know, instead of, if you're doing 52 weeks in a month, the one of the best things you could do is, you know, instead of just training all day, is analyze video and so that, like, by the time the next day comes around, you know exactly, you know, sit down with a coach or someone and each day and go through, okay, what can I work on tomorrow? You know, if you want to maximize how much you get out of it, then, you know, you're doing that every day and you're treating it as a professional that way, kind of like you would at a, like they do at a elite,
like an NFL type facility.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they review all the video from the day and they sit down and say, you know, this and fix that tomorrow. And, you know, I think doing it like that would be ideal.
Yeah, I think in my head, that's probably the thing that I would like really want to do the most. And I think that, you know, people get a little bit weird about filming and stuff like that with, you know, different training partners or whatever, but I think that would be like a prerequisite. It's like, hey, if you come to train, like, it's everything has to get filmed, because you know, obviously you're doing it for content, but I just think that learning, like, you could accelerate the learning so much quicker by really seeing. Because I mean, you know, the oldest golf adage in terms of like golf instructional and golf training is feel isn't real. And I think that that is just so true for every single thing that you're trying to learn. And we just don't have this first person view of ourselves. Like our consciousness allows us to see this whole out of our head that's like the infinity. And then, but we're not in that picture. Like at no point does my face or body, you know, you can look down at your legs, but you just don't get an accurate picture of what you're doing. And I think that to me would be one of the things that I think would improve your jiu-jitsu the most. I think in any like physical thing.
Yep, I agree.
Well, mate, we just did an extra hour and a half. I really appreciate your time. But yeah, I just needed to give the people the full Lockie Argy treatment. And there's a ton of good stuff in there, hopefully, for people that are either very deep in jiu-jitsu or interested in diving a little bit deeper. And yeah, well, I'll definitely keep you in the loop about this little month deal.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks, Jace. That was really good.
Appreciate it, man. Yeah, always,
good to,
always.
Good to chat again.
Yeah, always love talking to
you. Yeah, let me know about your month. I'm actually really keen to see how you go with it. I'd actually really be interested to see like a pre month roles and post month roles with the same people and just see how they look different. I think that would be like a real test and comparing it to just people who are just training like a regular schedule and you've done a year's worth. I think that would be that'd be really cool.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I hadn't thought. What's that?
Find people who are keen enough to let you roll with them, but like that, you know. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that would be interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I might, well, we'll go off record for now. So I'll just
no worries.
Thanks very much, Lockie.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you.